Good afternoon and welcome to Wildlife. I'm Briley Colton, a volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today we'll start off as Arizona Wildlife Views Day, and then we'll move into some other little knickknacks. First up is recipe for conservation. Imagine you are tasked with preparing a 5-course meal, but the only information provided is what the meal is supposed to look like. You have no recipe or idea what ingredients are needed. The only way to make the meal is to guess which ingredients you need, how much of each, and the order you need to add and cook them in. You keep trying different combinations, different cooking methods, and different amounts of each ingredient until the meal you prepare looks exactly like the picture. Sounds daunting, doesn't it? The scenario is similar to the one we've been facing at the Arizona Game and Fish Department's Aquatic Research and Conservation Center, or ARCC, while trying to recover two of the state's native endangered fish species, loach, minnow, and spike dace. These two species are found only in the Gila River Basin of Arizona and New Mexico. Populations are so low in the wild that managers rely on spawning these species in captivity so they can be stocked back into their natural habitats. The problem is that not much is known about how to spawn these fish. There's no recipe to follow, so staff at the ARCC have been trying different strategies for more than 10 years to spawn loach, minnow, and spike dace, each with their own specific requirements for spawning. Over the years, we've tried using round tanks, long linear tanks, and changing water flows to better mimic natural conditions, refining our approach with each test. Another challenge for spawning these fish is the number of fish available. We rely on bringing wild fish into the facility for our hatchery broodstock, a group of adult fish held solely for producing offspring. So we can maintain genetics similar to those in the wild, and because these fish are short-lived, with a lifespan typically fewer than 3 years, since wild populations are limited, only a handful of fish are available to bring into captivity, further restricting spawning efforts. In 2018, staff at the ARCC tried adding one more ingredient. We looked at how many fish should be placed in each spawning tank. Although this sounds simple, the number can drastically affect how successfully these fish spawn. For example, loach minnow, males are territorial and create nests, so too many fish in the tank can reduce spawning, as males spend too much time and energy defending nests. Spike dace also need open space within the water column so that males can chase females to spawn. The results were exceptional. Both loach minnow and spike dace had the best spawning year on record since the facility was created in the early 2000s. Almost 14,000 total fish were produced, far exceeding past production. To put it another way, more than 8 times more larval loach minnow were produced compared with 2017, and over 2 times more larval spike dace. In the future, staff at the ARCC will keep trying new techniques and strategies to build on the success of 2018, continuing to help the recovery of two of Arizona's most imperiled fish. By Christopher Starr. Resilience in the Pinaleno Mountains by Nathan Gonzalez. 1 year after their habitat was nearly wiped out by the 2017 Fry Fire in the Pinaleno Mountains in southeastern Arizona, an annual survey of the endangered Mount Graham red squirrel shows a notable increase in their population. The annual survey, conducted jointly by the Arizona Game and Fish Department, Colorado National Forest, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Arizona's Center for Nature Conservation, Phoenix Zoo, and the University of Arizona, resulted in a minimum estimate of 67 squirrels, a 91% increase from the 35 recorded in 2017, when populations were severely impacted by the Fry Fire. The subspecies was listed as endangered in 1987. Mount Graham red squirrels live only in the upper elevation conifer forests of the Pinaleno Mountains and feed primarily on the conifer seeds. This subspecies is highly territorial and has lower reproduction rates than red squirrels in other locations. Vertirim springnail. This is in Field Notes. The common name for this freshwater snail refers to its geographic location near the Vertirim in central Arizona. The Latinized species name describes the glandular appearance of the snail's penis, which distinguishes this species from other spring snails in Arizona. The adult shell is tiny, measuring up to an eighth of an inch in length. Their three or four whorls, which coil to the right, are unlike those of the common pond snails in Arizona, which coil to the left. Spring snails appear brown to green, depending on the substrate they live on. The Vertirim spring snail was first found in an old homestead site called Nelson Place Spring along Sycamore Creek in the Prescott National Forest. Over the past decade, several populations of this species were discovered 30 miles west of the Grapevine Springs area of the Bradshaw Mountains, and another population at Hutch Springs, also along the Vertirim, about 8 miles south of Nelson Place Spring. Spring snails live in spring-fed wetlands and streams, typically close to spring heads where the water issues out of the ground. They find shelter on rough textured rocks and submerged tree branches or leaf litter, preferring shallow, gentle flowing water that is clear and unpolluted. Spring snails are endemic to where they are found. That is, they are habitat specialists and are not widely distributed. Spring snails feed on young watercress, water pennywort, and the thin biofilm of algae and diatoms that covers leaf litter and rocks. Unlike most terrestrial snails, spring snails have separate sexes, with the females often larger than the males. Spring snails live about a year and deposit eggs on rocky or woody substrates. The Vertirim spring snail is identified as a species of greatest conservation need, a Tier 1A, in Arizona's State Wildlife Action Plan, and designated as a sensitive species by the United States Forest Service. Under Arizona's fishing regulations, the snail is prohibited from collection unless under a scientific collecting license. The Vertirim spring snail currently has no protections under the Endangered Species Act. In the near future, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service plans to evaluate the snail's status for listing as threatened or endangered, if warranted. Protecting and maintaining the wild snail populations and their habitat are the primary management goals for the species. Over the next year, the Arizona Game and Fish Department will be developing a multi-species conservation agreement for central Arizona spring snails, which will include the Vertirim spring snail. Similar conservation agreements for other spring snails and land snails in Arizona have been effective in managing our native mollusks in partnership with land management agencies, private landowners, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. At the Tailgate by Pat Crouch, we have Hot Pursuit. Game and fish officers often utilize creative means to contact people while they're hunting and fishing. Whether riding mules to check on backcountry hunters, paddling canoes to access remote river anglers, or sitting astride an all-terrain vehicle to keep up with off-highway vehicle users, our officers always find a way to get where they need to go. Many hunters, thinking they were in the middle of nowhere, have seemed shocked to find a wildlife manager standing next to them asking how their hunt is going. Years ago, the department launched the Urban Fishing Program in the greater Phoenix area, which has evolved into our very successful statewide community fishing program. The new fishing opportunities became popular with the regular summer fishing stock at our local lakes, also resulted in a number of violations. One warm summer day, I met a young game and fish officer, let's call him Tom, at Encanto Park to check anglers for license and limit compliance. We approached the lake utilizing available cover, and while I checked the closest fisherman, Tom scanned the area for anglers, quickly leaving the area. I heard Tom whisper, "We've got a runner." I handed the license back to the fisherman, and we sprang into action. The individual departing the lake was on the opposite shore, and we were certain he would reach his vehicle before we could check his license. As I was the veteran officer by at least two years, I knew what had to be done. We sprinted a short distance to the boat rental dock and advised the dock employee that we needed to commandeer a boat to effect a law enforcement action. Luckily, the employee had watched enough TV shows to know what commandeer meant. Tom and I jumped into the boat, and we left the dock with great enthusiasm. It was only a few minutes into our pursuit that we realized several flaws in our plan. First, the paddle boats are not as fast as we had hoped, and we even observed small children skipping along the shoreline faster than we could paddle. Second, as Tom was about a foot taller than me, we had difficulty synchronizing our efforts, and we traveled in a lazy S pattern across the lake. Third, the spectacle of two uniformed officers flailing across a lake in a bright blue paddle boat with the name Enchantment One on it didn't have the intimidation level we envisioned. At some point, the angler in question stopped his departure and stared at us as we reached the shore where he had been fishing. I believe he was either fascinated by our tactics or lulled into a relaxed state from the sound of water churning over the paddles of our boat. Tom ended up citing the individual for not having a community fishing license, and justice was served. We were applauded by the anglers we passed on the slow trip back to the boat dock. I'm still not sure whether they were pleased by our law enforcement action or just enjoyed the unexpected entertainment that we provided. Now, from the Animal Defense Fund, what is the Animal Welfare Act? The AWA is the primary federal animal protection law. The AWA, which was signed into law in 1966, mainly involves animals kept at zoos and used in laboratories, as well as animals who are commercially bred and sold, such as those in puppy mills. The AWA directs the Secretary of the United States Department of Agriculture to set minimum standards regarding animals' handling, care, treatment, and transportation. Dogfighting and cockfighting are also prohibited under the Animal Welfare Act, so long as the activity in some way crosses state lines. The AWA is problematic on several levels. The law itself, which provides only minimal protections, and its enforcement by the Department of Agriculture are frequently criticized as allowing inhumane practices to go unchecked. Additionally, the AWA does not apply to animals on farms or to roughly 95% of the animals tested upon in labs, such as rats, mice, birds, fish, and reptiles. In 1998, establishing the right of animal advocates to challenge federal agencies' treatment of animals. When the Animal Legal Defense Fund discovered a chimpanzee named Barney in a U.S. Department of Agriculture, or USDA, licensed zoo, he was languishing in solitary confinement on the cement floor of a cage. Deprived of companionship and veterinary care, Barney suffered from severe psychological and physical distress until he escaped from his cage and was subsequently shot and killed by a park employee. In 1996, the Animal Legal Defense Fund successfully sued the USDA for failing to adopt minimum standards for the humane treatment of primates at research facilities and roadside zoos. U.S. District Court Judge Charles Ritchie ruled that the USDA had violated the Animal Welfare Act and must rewrite its rules to prevent animal suffering and ensure the psychological well-being of captive primates. Judge Ritchie called the USDA's failure to issue such standards egregious. The ruling established the right of animal advocates to challenge the USDA's rules regarding the treatment of animals under the AWA. The decision was reversed in 1997 when a panel of judges of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit ruled that the individual plaintiffs, who were regular visitors of the zoo, lacked legal standing. But after rehearing the case, the Federal Appeals Court ruled on September 1, 1998, that the plaintiffs did have standing. They suffered direct harm witnessing the terrible living conditions of primates at the zoo. A major legal victory. 2001, securing justice for abused elephant and legal recognition that violence does not stop a species, does not stop at species lines. In April 2000, an Oregon Zoo staff member in full view of witnesses used a bullhook, a long stick with a pointed metal hook on its end, to beat and sodomize Rose II, a 6-year-old elephant. Though prosecutors initially believed Oregon's laws prevented them from charging Rose II's abuser, with the American Legal Defense Fund's extensive legal assistance and highlighting the mounting public outcry, they successfully secured a conviction. The Animal Legal Defense Fund followed up this victory by drafting Oregon's Rose II bill, which became law in 2001. Two of the legal leaps forward included the Rose II's bill were statutorily recognizing connections between domestic violence and animal cruelty, and removing the requirement that prosecutors prove an animal victim experienced pain, a technically complicated undertaking, in order to charge animal cruelty. These changes mean, for example, that abusing an animal as part of terrorizing a child is treated with particular seriousness. Similarly, in the wake of Rose II's bill, prosecutors in Oregon no longer need to prove that the emotion experienced by an elephant with over 126 cuts on her body is pain. Instead, the legal question is simply whether the defendant injured the animal. Laws like Rose II's bill that acknowledge violence to animals seldom stops there. Fortunately, are becoming more common. For example, nearly 2/3 of states now allow companion animals to be included in domestic violence protective orders. 2012, Animal Legal Defense Fund frees Ben the Bear from Roadside Zoo. Ben the Bear languished for years at Jamba's Ranch, a North Carolina roadside zoo. Ben lived alone in a dirty concrete cage that measured just 12 by 22 feet. In the wild, bears love to swim, climb trees, and run. Ben could do none of those things. Instead, he ate dog food in a barren cage with only a few pieces of wood and a ball as company. He endured noisy tourists and crying children each day, all day long. Ben was often observed pacing, caused by extreme psychological stress and pressing his head against the chain-link fence that kept him prisoner. In conjunction with PETA, the Animal Legal Defense Fund filed a suit against Jamba's Ranch on behalf of two concerned North Carolina residents under North Carolina's unique civil enforcement statute, which allows any private citizen or organization to bring civil cases against abusers for violating animal cruelty laws. The court agreed that Ben's cage and living conditions did not meet the requirements necessary for his health and well-being. After the judge granted a preliminary injunction, Ben was flown to California to live in a spacious habitat at the Performing Animal Welfare Society's sanctuary. For likely the first time in his life, Ben was able to swim in his own pool, sleep in a straw nest under oak trees, and feel the grass underneath his paws. The judge later issued a permanent injunction. 2014, every animal counts. In State versus Nix, the defendant attempted to merge all 20 of his animal neglect convictions down to just one, convincing the trial court that 20 goats and horses involved were not themselves crime victims. In other words, going for an abuse one, get the rest free sentence. The Oregon Supreme Court ruled that individual animals can be considered crime victims when harmed by criminal abuse or neglect. On the same day, the Oregon Supreme Court issued another groundbreaking ruling holding in State versus Fessenden that an officer, despite not having a warrant, acted properly in seizing a horse near death from neglect and transporting her to a veterinarian for immediate medical care. In ruling that the exigent circumstances exception applied to the officer's actions, the Oregon Supreme Court described the horse as being the victim of the defendant's criminal cruelty, and wrote that the officer had a responsibility to prevent the perpetrator from causing further imminent harm to the victim, whether the victim was animal or human. Though Nix was ultimately vacated on unrelated procedural grounds in 2015, the Nix rule went back into effect. The Court of Appeals adopted the Oregon Supreme Court's rationale and affirmed multiple convictions in a cat hoarding case, State versus Hess, ruling that each animal qualified as a crime victim for sentencing purposes. Fessenden has remained good law throughout. The Animal Legal Defense Fund assisted in the Nix and Fessenden appeals, as well as the prosecution of Hess, Subsequently, the Animal Legal Defense Fund has used legal arguments deployed in Nix and Hess to successfully counter the abuse won, get the rest free sentencing structures at both the state and federal level, building legal recognition that each animal and each animal's interests is not being subject to cruelty counts. 2016, a precedent-setting victory Endangered Species Act protects captive animals. In the span of 2 years, five tigers died at Cricket Hollow Zoo in Manchester, Iowa, due to inadequate veterinary care. Another tiger was found to be suffering from open wounds, untreated by a veterinarian. A capuchin monkey, also denied veterinary care, had lost her hair and was found chewing her tail. Clear indications of severe boredom and frustration. Additionally, during this time, at least five lemurs died. Over the course of several years, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, or USDA, had documented a long and horrifying list of federal Animal Welfare Act violations at Cricket Hollow Zoo. These included animals who died of exposure to harsh weather, animals suffering with untreated injuries, animals being handled improperly, small, filthy enclosures, lack of access to clean water and food, and food contaminated with vermin. In 2016, the U.S. Court for the Northern District of Iowa found that the ESA is applicable to captive animals and that Cricket Hollow Zoo violated that law. The court ordered that the four remaining tigers and three remaining lemurs be removed from the zoo. In 2018, a three-judge panel of the Eighth Circuit upheld the district court's ruling that Cricket Hollow Zoo violated the ESA. In doing so, this case set an important precedent for stronger protection of captive animals. The Animal Legal Defense Fund filed a lawsuit arguing that Cricket Hollow Zoo's mistreatment of animals constituted a violation of the Federal Endangered Species Act. 2017, War on Wildlife Services. Millions of native wild animals, including coyotes, mountain lions, foxes, bobcats, and bears, are targeted and killed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Wildlife Services, whose programs often rely on outdated science and employ painful killing methods, such as leg-hold traps and wire snares. In July 2017, the Animal Legal Defense Fund filed a lawsuit against Wildlife Services for failing to comply with the National Endowment Policy Act, which requires the agency to account for harm it causes to native wildlife. Because of this lawsuit in October 2017, Wildlife Services agreed to comply with the obligations under NEPA and conduct an environmental analysis of wildlife management activities in California's North District. The lawsuit was dismissed in exchange for this settlement agreement, and the agency's compliance will be monitored as it conducts an updated review. 2017, fighting for Tony the Tiger's status as an individual. For more than 7 years, the Animal Defense Fund fought tirelessly on multiple fronts to free Tony, a Siberian Bengal tiger held in a small cage at the Tiger Truck Stop in Grosse Tete, Louisiana. In 2012, we obtained a judgment prohibiting Louisiana from issuing any further permits for Tony's captivity. The judgment should have required Louisiana to transfer Tony to a reputable sanctuary where he could have spent the last years of his life in a naturalistic environment with space to run and swim. Following our victory, however, the state legislature amended the Louisiana Big Cat Ban to exempt the Tiger Truck Stop. The Animal League Defense Fund quickly challenged the law in court. Tragically, Tony passed away before the law was declared unconstitutional. But our work on Tony's behalf did not end with his death. In addition to educating countless Americans about the plight of captive wildlife, Tony is part of an important lawsuit that asks the government to recognize animals as the individuals they are. Prior to Tony's passing in the fall of 2017, the Animal Legal Defense Fund filed a Freedom of Information Act request seeking records related to his death and well-being. We sought expedited processing, which FOIA requires when delaying the disclosure, could reasonably be expected to pose an imminent threat to the life or physical safety of an individual. After the USDA asserted that the term individual only applies to humans, not to a captive tiger, and refused to expedite our request. we filed a lawsuit. Oral arguments in the case are scheduled for the summer. And 2019, engaging the legal community on animals' behalf. Since the Pro Bono Network's inception in 1999, the Animal Legal Defense Fund has secured more than 63,000 pro bono hours for various projects, totaling more than $23 million in legal work for animals. The country's largest pro bono network for animal protection has grown to 2,400 talented individual law professionals and 450 law firms nationwide. Nationwide, there are now over 200 Animal League Defense Fund student chapters and over 165 law schools offering one or more animal law class. And lastly, in their magazine Endangered Earth, the Center for Biological Diversity have some things that they're working on. Beluga whales. We sued the Trump administration for authorizing an oil company to harm endangered beluga whales through its offshore drilling operations in Cook Inlet, Alaska. The inlet's tiny population of belugas is facing serious threats from Hilcorp's seismic blasting and other dangerous oil and gas activities. Endangered art. Artists Roger Pete and Tricia Tripp completed the center's 22nd endangered species mural, a 105-foot-long painting in Seward, Alaska, that depicts rare seabirds called spectacle eiders, as well as endangered North Pacific right whales. West Coast orcas. Following a center lawsuit against the Trump administration for failing to provide habitat protection, orcas need to survive the feds proposed in September to expand critical habitat protection for endangered southern resident orcas to more than 15,000 square miles off the West Coast. Humboldt martens. The Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission voted this fall to ban the trapping of Humboldt martens, a species the center has petitioned to protect under the Endangered Species Act. There are fewer than 200 left in Oregon. California fur trapping ban. In a major milestone, California has become the nation's first state to outlaw fur trapping. The Wildlife Protection Act of 2019, pursued and backed by the center, was signed by Governor Gavin Newsom in September. It prohibits trapping native animals, plus selling their pelts. And that will end this week's Wildlife. I'm Briley Colton, a volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. I encourage you to get out there and enjoy that wildlife around you. Have a good one.